Michael, that's the biggest bottle of champagne you've had so far in all the other finals. I mean, does that also reflect the fact that maybe this finals accomplishment may be your greatest, all things considered?
No, when we get six, it's going to be bigger.
That was Michael Jordan, showing off his supreme confidence right after winning his fifth NBA title in 1997. But the following season, Jordan's final one with the Bulls, would prove to be more turbulent and difficult than anyone could have imagined. Today, ahead of Sunday's premiere of The Last Dance, our 10-part series on Jordan's final season, we talked to a man who covered MJ up close, Michael Wilbon, about that championship run and why he thinks Jordan's career will never be matched. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Friday, April 17th. This is ESPN Daily. Have you watched any of these yet? The Last Dance?
No, I have not, purposely. I have them on my computer. I'm not going to watch them until I'm going to consume them like everybody else.
Mm. So you're going to live tweet for the people?
I doubt it. I want to watch it. This is the old man thing. People who are tweeting aren't watching. I mean, I know you all think you're watching, but you're not watching. I learned this from accounts of basketball games with all my younger sports writer friends who are tweeting instead of watching the damn game, and they don't watch the game.
Michael Wilbon is the host of Pardon the Interruption. So, Michael, the long-awaited release of the 10-hour ESPN Films documentary on the 1997-1998 Chicago Bulls, The Last Dance, is finally upon us. Episodes 1 and 2 drop Sunday night at 9 on ESPN. As a lifelong Chicago sports fan, Chicago native who is quarantined right now, what is your level of excitement for this?
It would be off the charts even if it had aired as it was supposed to, as scheduled, during the NBA Finals. I mean, I would have been thrilled about it then. Now you throw in this element of no programming of any sort that's original now when it comes to sports, and now you've created an event. And they're calling it, right, a documentary event. It is an event. And that's one reason why I'm not watching it in advance. An event means you partake like everybody else in the event. And I'm going to watch it as if I would have in 1997 or 8, which is you watch it at night. You go talk about it around the water cooler the next day. And so that's how I'm going to consume it.
What were you doing in 1997?
I was living in Washington, just like I am now, but was working for the Washington Post as a columnist. So covering everything, but a heavy emphasis on the NBA, which I had covered a lot. And so in the spring of 1997-98, so let's go straight 22 years ago, I would have been probably not at a first round Bulls series, probably at some other series I just picked out of the sky. And then when the Bulls, after they won their first round, I would go join it, like a million other sports writers. That was our job, to cover Michael Jordan. It was like covering the president, but without Twitter. And he knew the people who did this year after year from the LA Times and the USA Today and the New York Times and New York Post and New York Daily News and the Philly papers and the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan and Jackie McMullen and David Aldridge and myself at the Washington Post. And Michael knew all these people. And it was the same faces. It was the same faces for like more than a decade. Not to mention the Chicago people. And we all covered it. That's what we did.
5 seconds remaining in regulation. The inbound.
Coming out of the 1997 finals, the first Bulls-Jazz finals, and you know the Bulls had just won their fifth title, what was being said about this team?
You know, you started having these debates back then, and people didn't have hot takes. They gave their opinions, and their opinions were considerably informed. Like when Bob Ryan gave his opinion and wanted to compare this team to the 86 Celtics, I was going to listen to that. I didn't want to listen to anyone who didn't know the history of the NBA. That was a waste of my time. And so people were starting to make these comparisons and compare them to other teams. How did they stack up with the 67 Philadelphia team that won a championship? And so there were conversations how good were they? If they could play one more time, run it back one more time for a sixth time, how good would they be then? But nobody expected to go on forever, Mina, because people were already talking about the cost of it. What were they going to pay Jordan? What were they going to have to pay Jordan and Phil Jackson? The salaries, the numbers being thrown around didn't sound like nothing, but they were extraordinary at the time.
Michael, obviously, in the wake of this incredible celebration, there'll be some very difficult business decisions for sure. Jerry Reinsdorf. Can you please, as to your best ability, lay out the scenario that you would like to see unfold and the one that you expect to unfold because of money considerations, particularly involving Scottie Pippen's future?
Well, you want me to be GM, I guess. Take Jerry Krause's position.
Let's talk about that, the salaries, because, you know, Pippen wanted to get paid, but ownership wouldn't do it. What kind of dissent was there around that headed into the 1997 season?
You know, I don't know that there was any dissent other than Scottie's dissent.
Scottie, there's a lot of question marks about what's going to happen with this team next season. If you could look past the euphoria of tonight about yourself, how comfortable are you with the idea of returning here next year?
I feel pretty comfortable. I had my hands, my fingers, and everything crossed that we were going to win the championship and everybody would be back and we'll be a happy family again. So I feel pretty good about our chances of keeping this ball club together.
Scottie was a great player who, to me, the longer we go away from that whole, you know, six championship period in 8 years, the further we move away from it, the more embarrassed I am that I was part of the chorus of voices who didn't adequately appreciate Scottie Pippen. I mean, he's one of the great players of all time. Not just a Hall of Famer, not just a guy who was a sidekick. He's one of the great players of all time. And we can see that now that we look at all court players and say, oh, this guy's so great. And like, really? Because he's not as good as Scottie. And just how hard it was to play off Michael, to play off a great, great, great player. Very few people understand how great that is, and even fewer have the ability to do it.
What were Jordan's thoughts on Scottie's contract and whether the roster should be rebuilt at all?
I don't know that 20 years ago, 20 years is not like, you know, five lifetimes, but I don't know that people talked about other people's contracts like this. There was no Twitter. There was no daily discussion of this. And I don't know that we even ask as much about it. We might ask a guy about his own contract and whether he was going to hold out or come back or needed to be traded. There was some of that, but there wasn't the daily obsession with it that we have now and constant reporting of it and constant harping. It just wasn't. And Michael didn't want to rebuild. There was a great line he had. I don't know if this will be in the doc or not. And he said, I don't want to rebuild.
Rebuilding? No one's guaranteeing rebuilding is going to be 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years. Cubs have been rebuilding for 42 years.
And there's this just unbelievable laughter from the people listening. So just do the math. The Cubs have been in the World Series in 1945. And 42 years later, well, it wasn't 19. He was about 10 years short, maybe, of the analogy. But the analogy was right on the money. Rebuilding didn't mean anything. And I know Jerry Krause might have thought. I mean, Jerry Krause thought a lot of himself. I mean, I don't want to speak ill of the dead. But Jerry Krause thought a lot of himself. And he was damn good at what he did. But he wasn't as good at what he did as Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Phil Jackson is what they did. He was fine rebuilding. He thought he could take the picks and go out and do anything. And as we've seen subsequently, that's not exactly the case.
How was Jerry Krause, who was the GM of the Bulls during this era, how was he perceived at the time inside the organization?
Well, his owner thought a lot of him. He should. I mean, Jerry did some nice work. He did not draft Michael Jordan, but he was there for sort of the rearranging of the team a little bit with opening up playing time for Horace Grant, who I think is one of the unsung heroes of those first three championship teams, bringing Bill Cartwright in and shipping out Jordan's favorite teammate at the time, Charles Oakley. And there's a lot of that stuff that Jerry Krause did. Draft night, setting it up to get Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant. There's a lot of stuff he did that was great. But also, there was some derision within. I mean, he got the nickname Crumbs Krause from Michael Jordan because he had crumbs on his suit all the time because he was eating something that wound up being a mess. And it was like it's like the Pigpen character in Charlie Brown. The players looked at him as sort of, you know, maybe they had respect for the savant nature of what he did. And they also thought he was sort of obnoxious and a guy they could do without. And, you know, there was quite a range of thought about Jerry Krause.
So going into the season, there's tension between Bulls management and the players about whether to rebuild. Michael Jordan is 34 years old, and he is thinking about his own career trajectory. He's got 5 championships under his belt. What was his mindset like before the season?
Win another one. I mean, he said, you know, I think in the same press conference where he said something about the Cubs have been rebuilding for 42 years and where's it gotten them? You win until somebody beats you.
We're entitled to defend what we have until we lose it. If we lose it, then you look at it and you say, okay, let's change. Let's just...
It was pretty simple. Nobody can beat us now. We took care of the Pistons. We got them out of the way. We even beat somebody who I know he had supreme respect for, Magic Johnson.
And the Chicago Bulls have won their first ever NBA championship.
They beat a team with Hall of Famers, Clyde Drexler and Danny Ainge and Terry Porter.
Time running down. The Chicago Bulls have won the NBA championship for the second straight season.
They beat Charles Barkley on a team that was loaded with great players in Phoenix in 93.
Here's Patrick for three. Yes! The Bulls.
They beat Gary Payton and Sean Kemp. They beaten Stockton and Malone. So they beaten all these Hall of Famers. I mean, they beat everybody on the Dream Team except Larry Bird. And so, you know, let's go. Let's run it back. We have beaten everybody, and we'll keep doing this until somebody stops us.
Coming up, what it was like covering Jordan up close. And Michael shares some of his best stories about his airness. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing 2 really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup, so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Michael, take us all the way back. When was the first time you remember seeing Michael Jordan play basketball?
This freshman year in North Carolina. When I was covering the ACC for the Washington Post, I saw Michael early on, in person. And, you know, Coach Dean Smith. People like to make fun of Dean Smith and say, oh, you know, the only person to hold him under 20 is Dean Smith. The person, maybe the one of the few coaches who could have gotten him to have that foundation is Dean Smith. I mean, I wrote a piece where Michael told me that the 3 most important men in his life were his father, Dean Smith, and Phil Jackson. And I get that. I got to see Michael way more than most people as a freshman in college, because that's when college basketball is truly regional. And he was developing and he was growing.
And now we are ready for the 3rd pick. And the Chicago Bulls, who have been drafting very high down through the years, and they have the 3rd pick today.
The Chicago Bulls pick Michael Jordan of the University of North Carolina.
After he was drafted, when did you first realize that he was going to be a franchise-altering player for your squad?
You know, probably about a month in. I remember calling my brother, who is a season ticket holder to this day in Chicago at the old Chicago Stadium. And I remember calling my brother after Jordan's first game. He just showed you there's no league pass. You couldn't see the game. You didn't know what was going on. And I remember saying to him, what did Jordan do?
Jordan to the hoop. King of the air. Score!
not a bad opening performance for a young rookie. I tell you, he's going to make an impact on this league in a hurry.
And I was like, oh my God, this could be different. But it was like, what did Michael do? And right then, everybody started doing that every night. What did Jordan do? What did Michael do? I talked to my brother pretty much every night, every time the Bulls played. And they weren't that great. I mean, they were under 500. But they made the playoffs, and you wanted to know what Jordan did. What did the Bulls do? What did Jordan do?
What was the reaction from people around the league to his play in those early days?
Well, remember, then it was a mixed bag. There were people in the conservative basketball community that thought he shot too much. He was a ball hog, that he took way too many shots. You know, coming in, it was, he's not going to have a jump shot. Well, that was a lie. Well, we don't know if he can play facing the basket. I mean, okay. Yeah, right. And so, but there was still, you know, look, that dogged Michael for years. That wasn't the first year. There were people who won at the highest level who would say, you know, he takes a lot of shots, doesn't trust his teammates. That was going around until they got to the conference finals against Detroit. That was going around till then. There were people who didn't think he could win, that Michael could win like that. Magic came out once and said,
Michael Jordan is not only the best basketball player, but he's the most exciting basketball player to ever play. We only dream about doing things that he can do. And that being,
he just said it. The fact that Magic and Bird didn't buy this other garbage, I think that had a lot to do with changing perception.
One of the facets of Jordan's career that's covered in the doc, Michael, is not just his life on the court, but his life off of it, his brand, how big he got. I'm wondering, what was it like covering him because of that, because of how famous he was?
Well, it like increased exponentially, Mina, when he came back after the year and a half away.
A sellout crowd and a deluge of cameras and commentary, both foreign and domestic, appeared in playoff-like force, demonstrating what can happen to just another regular season game when a superstar comes out of retirement.
The 1985 through 1993, Michael, that grew gradually. Then he came back. And people say, well, he's like a rock star. No, he wasn't like a rock star. Rock stars were lucky to be like him. And I remember two incidents. One, I'm sitting on a flight going to Chicago before a playoff game in 96. And I'm sitting next to, and this is not a fictional story. This is a real story. I'm sitting next to a nun. And we're talking about why we're going to Chicago. And I told her I'd gone to St. Ignatius College Prep, a nice little Jesuit school that she knew a lot about, knew people that taught me. And we're talking about a lot of different stuff. And the conversation rolls around, as every conversation then did, to the Bulls if you were living in Chicago. And she was. So anyway, we talked for a while. And then she said, okay, you got to give me 10 minutes to do something. I didn't know what she was talking about. Well, as it turns out, she was writing a letter to Jordan. She's writing a letter to Michael in her seat. And at the end of this, she handed it to me. She put it in an envelope. She wrote his name on it. And she said, I'm asking you a favor. Will you please give this to Michael Jordan?
Oh, no.
And I'm like, okay. I just never do stuff like that. I just never do. So I go to the locker room pregame, and I go over, and media is being kicked out. And I said, look, I've never done this. I have to give you this envelope. It's from a nun. And he just chuckles. And I'm sure he has no memory of this at all, nor should he. And he said, okay. And I never asked him if he read it. I never asked him what it said. A nun gave me an envelope. But that's how big he became on the back end. The other one I've written about in the Washington Post, when a long limousine pulls up, Jordan's third game back, I believe, was in Washington at Capitol Center. And a guy who's an attaché or something, he rolls down the window. He has to speak to Tim Hallam, who was the Bulls' veteran, savvy. I get a smile just thinking about him, PR guy during all the Jordan years, and be honest, to this day. And he said, can I speak to Tim Hallam? And Tim, it's like, I'm Tim Hallam. And there's a woman, and the window goes back down in the back, and she's wearing a tiara. She's sitting in the back. And this attaché says, I'm here. This is the crown princess of some country, and she would like to meet Mr. Jordan. And you're like, this is not happening. I am standing here with a pen and paper. This is a column if I've ever seen one. I'm standing there. I'm not even sure why. This is just right place, right time. And this is during shoot-around, so it's like 11 o'clock in the morning. 11 o'clock, this woman drives out from Embassy Row with this attaché, and she's in the back with this tiara on. And Hallam looks at this guy and says, buddy, there's a crown princess in every city.
Yeah.
That delayed laugh you had is the that's what I didn't take time to laugh. I just started writing stuff down. And it was the lead of my column in the Washington Post the next day, I am sure. And it must have been in the playoffs like a few weeks later. And Michael said to me, why did you do that? Why did you write that? I'm like, that is a great story. He's like, that was, you humiliated people. You killed this woman. Why did you do this? And it was, but this is what it became. This is what it became on the other side. Mm-hmm. It became this obsession that people had. And there's nothing like it. People can think there's something like it. There isn't. Everybody's accessible now. People tweet, people are on Instagram. You can see everything about them all the time. LeBron, you can find a piece of LeBron everywhere, all the time. You can't find Jordan everywhere. You don't know what his inside of his house looked like. You didn't see pictures of him just posed with his family. You didn't know every thought he had. People didn't know that. It wasn't tweeted out. It wasn't public. And so it's different. There wasn't anybody like him. And because of the nature of communication in the world, there ain't going to be anybody else like him.
If you guys remember in 1984 when they drafted Michael Jordan to the city of Chicago, he's never experienced. I said then when I got here in this city that we would be champions by the time I leave. Well, we're a five-time champion going for six. If we never win another one, we're certainly going to win the sixth one. And we need your support. Thank you very, very much.
What was he like as a player during that final season? How was he different from previous years?
He wasn't as spectacular as he was, you know, in those seasons. I mean, my son is 12 and he goes back and he looks at some of the stuff. Anytime he starts to say, he'll say stuff like, Dad, you know who was a better dunker than Michael Jordan? I'm like, stop right there. Get YouTube. Call it up. Call it up. Go to 1985. Go to the Patrick Ewing and the Knicks in the Garden in the playoffs game, whatever it was. Starks, Ewing, Oakley twice. You get, just go to that and then shut up. People don't even know. They don't even remember. They don't know. Kids don't know Zion wasn't born before when the Last Dance occurred. They don't know. They don't know that they weren't as good as him. They weren't. They don't know that they can't dunk like him. They can't move like him. They can't play with either hand like him. They can't defend like him. They can't. And I'm going to include the best of today's players. They weren't. They can't. And so they're going to see that. And by the end of it, by 1997-98, to answer your question, it was more gamesmanship involved. He couldn't physically do exactly what he could do in 1991. And so, you know, sometimes my son will say to me, well, Dad, he didn't score his points like Harden. No, he didn't. He didn't keep the ball and go between his legs for 22 seconds. He didn't. And people called him a ball hog. And I say to my son, people called Michael a ball hog. But I tell you what, I would not pay to watch James Harden. I don't want to see that.
Wow.
I don't want to pay to see that. And there are players, and I say that James Harden is a great player, a first ballot Hall of Famer. I ain't paying to see that. People pay to see it now because they don't know any better. If they think that James Harden was as spectacular to watch as Magic or Michael, they are fools. And they need to go to YouTube. But Jordan, by his last year, he did not have that, but he had something else. He had that turnaround jumper, that fadeaway, the guile with which he played, the intellect with which he incorporated Scotty and Ron Harper and Rodman. He got Rodman to toe the line for 3 years. I mean, who could do that?
What are you hoping to learn from this series about him?
I'm going in with no expectations. None. I don't know. Because I don't know what was said on planes. I don't know what was said in locker rooms. Sometimes Phil would tell us a story in which something came out of nowhere. You're like, oh my God, I never knew that. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not going in with preconceived notions. I look forward to the stuff I don't know. And I look forward to the stuff I do know being retold or seeing it for the first time in 20 years or 30 years. I mean, this whole thing, this is not just The Last Dance. It's looking at Michael's career through The Last Dance. this is a good story. This is one of the best stories you could ever have in sports. We couldn't have this story about Babe Ruth. We had it about Muhammad Ali. People told stories in depth about Ali for decades. And now we're getting Jordan. And those three guys, to me, are separate and apart from everybody else. Even the great of the great, like Jim Brown and Magic and Larry. But I can't wait to see this because I know there's a whole hell of a lot of stuff I don't know.
Me too. And I hope the kids of America watch, but without their phones.
I hope they watch. I hope they stop tweeting. And if my son picks up his phone, I'm throwing him out of the house. Yes, at 12 years old.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. It's good talking with you.
Mike Wilbon might not be live tweeting The Last Dance, but you can catch his thoughts on Twitter and Instagram at @RealMikeWilbon. Coming up, one runner goes the distance without straying far from home. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. Here's another story I want you to know. While distance running is a fairly solitary sport, even ultra marathoners have had to make adjustments these days since tracks and trails across the country are closed. And yet, like everyone else, they've improvised, which is how we ended up with the Quarantine Backyard Ultra, which is pretty much what it sounds like. About 2,000 runners entered virtually, and Michael Wardian of Arlington, Virginia won the whole thing. We chatted earlier this week. Michael, congratulations. What did you win?
I won a golden roll of toilet paper.
Well, that's incredible. Tell me, what is an ultramarathon normally like and how is this one different?
So I guess it's a kind of a wide definition. So an ultramarathon is any distance longer than a traditional marathon. And for your audience that may not be familiar with that, that is 26.2 miles or 42 kilometers. So the traditional distances for ultramarathon are traditionally like it's anywhere from 50K to 100 miles. The thing that made the Quarantine Backyard Ultra a little bit different is that it is, you run 4.166 miles every hour on the hour until nobody wants to go anymore. The race only finishes when there's one person left. It was 262 miles. 0.5. So basically 10 marathons we did in 2.5 days.
Where did you do it?
I did it about 50 feet from my front door. So I'm based in Arlington, Virginia, and I ran a loop that was 0.44 miles. So a little longer than a quarter lap of your high school track.
Was that unbelievably boring?
Actually, it was unbelievably exciting. It was so cool. Because, you know, as you know, there's like absolutely nothing else going on in the world at the moment. So it was like the big highlight of our neighborhood called Arlington Forest. So I was like basically the entertainment for like 2.5 days. People were like, you know, waking up at all times of the day to, you know, be a part of it and cheer out their window, like little old ladies. And I had like 10-year-old kids that were setting their alarm for like 4 o'clock in the morning to like come and cheer. And we had a big aid station, which is kind of just like a camping table set up with like pizza and sushi and, you know, coconut water and that kind of stuff on it. And you know, I just would sit there for a couple of minutes and then at the top of the hour start running again.
When did it occur to you that you were going to win?
It didn't. I don't know if you know the story, but it started out, there was like around 2,400 of us all around the world. Like there were people running in like their living room. There was people running around like boarded up coffee shops. I was running around my block. There was people that were like in quarantine countries, like where they couldn't actually go outside. So they were running on treadmills. And then eventually around 200 miles, I think it was down to like two or three of us. It came between just me and one other guy. There was a guy named Radek who was based in the Czech Republic. And so for 16 hours, we just kept running against each other. And so it was just like this mano-a-mano battle, you know? So it was like East versus West. And it was kind of like two different styles too, because I'm running outside, he's running on a treadmill. So then around 63 hours, he had a little, like, I think he just got a little bit tired. If you don't start right away on the hour, you get disqualified. And so you have to start moving exactly on the hour. And he took about 2 minutes to start moving. And so they disqualified him. Yeah, so I ended up finding out like halfway through my first loop of the street, and I wasn't sure if I was going to win or not, but I ended up running like my fastest loop of the race.
It's kind of cool though, right, that you were competing against someone halfway across the world.
Oh my God, it was so awesome. And it's also cool, like, you're kind of like, you know, doing strategy, like, okay, you know, it's about to be night for him. So, you know, maybe he's going to get tired, and then he made it through the night. So then like, he's like, oh, well now I'm about to get tired. It's just cool that, you know, even though we were separated physically, the running community was able to come together and be a part of something, you know, and to have 2,400 people like take part in like in all different circumstances. Like there was one lady, super baller. She was like running across like a frozen lake in like Norway or Sweden or somewhere.
All right. You've inspired me. I'm going to run for 25 minutes instead of 20 minutes today. It's happening.
That is awesome, man. And I hope so. Like, I think that's actually been one of the greatest things is like, I've actually noticed like a lot of people running the loop that I created in our neighborhood. You'd be surprised. Like your 25 minutes maybe will inspire somebody where you are.
Maybe. All right. Thanks so much, Michael.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Ina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Russell DiNallo, Troy Farkas, David Cerosi, and Connor Burks. I'll talk to you Monday.